You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, Gordon Evans talks with Bridge reporter Ted Roloffs about Michigan State University interim president John Engler's handling of allegations of sexual assault in Michigan prisons during his time as governor. But first, did you know that Generation Xers and Millennials are expected to become the most significant philanthropists in history? So says Grand Valley State University's Johnson Center for Philanthropy in a new report titled 11 Trends for Philanthropy for 2018. I spoke with one of the researchers, Michael Moody, the center's Frey Foundation Chair for Family Philanthropy. Welcome to WMUK.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I should point out that when we talk about philanthropy here at the center and really in our field more broadly, we mean philanthropy in a broad sense. So it covers also trends about how things are happening in the nonprofit world, you know, certain dynamics that are going on in terms of how people are coming together in communities to address problems through various activities that they do voluntarily or through their nonprofit organization. So it's not just giving of money in the traditional sense of philanthropy. So these trends are much broader than that. Which is another reason why they're sort of more than just applying to 2018.
Let's start with one that really jumped out to me, and that involves younger givers. And you were involved with this particular research. One of the biggest trends that intrigued me is the prediction that Generation Xers and Millennials with capacity for making major gifts will likely be the most significant generation of philanthropists in history. Can you put some flesh on that?
This is one that's going to be significant for many decades to come, and we're just beginning to get a handle on what the next generation of major donors want to do. I just published a book on this. The book's called Generation Impact. And what we say in the book is basically that the most significant philanthropists ever are just coming into their roles right now as donors. You know, we know on the one hand that the next generation, that is the sort of Gen Xers and Millennials who are just coming onto the scene, either making their own money or being the beneficiaries of this historic wealth transfer and wealth concentration that we see going on, they're going to simply have more resources to give as big donors for the next several decades, more resources than any group of major donors in the past. And they really want to give those in new ways. So they want to change how they give and how they interact with the nonprofit organizations that are, frankly, very dependent on them as their major donors. You know, we talk in the book and in this piece that we published by the Johnson Center, but really what's happening is that they want to give to the same causes, education, healthcare, poverty, these kind of causes that have been the focus of philanthropy for a long time, but they want to give in new ways to them. They want to innovate how we address some of those problems. And I think that's really where this fundamental change is happening. Much more engaged major donors that are trying out new things, willing to experiment on new approaches. And they want to be much more close with the organizations that they support. They want to be more hands-on to give their talent as well as their considerable treasure. And that means that the nonprofits have to engage these major donors in different ways.
So is that the main way that they're different, that they want to be a little more hands-on?
Yes. I mean, again, there's many ways in which things will continue. They still want to give with their families, and they still give from a place of values, you know, being driven by their values, and they want to give to the same causes. But there is going to be a fundamental change, and it revolves around those issues of how they want to engage with organizations and how they want to create impact. You know, the old tool belt that was available to big donors in the past, which was primarily about, you know, writing checks to established nonprofit organizations, that's going to continue, but it's going to be one tool among many in the tool belt that these major donors want to achieve. So they're going to want to change how they invest their assets. They're going to want to change how they give with other people in collaborative ways. And they want to, you know, change how deeply they're involved with one or two organizations that are their clear focus rather than the more traditional approach, which is spread out their money. They want to really focus on one organization, go deep with that group and try to achieve change.
I want to dig a little bit deeper in terms of the demographics of this group. Are you really more referring to just a segment of Generation Xers and Millennials? Because I thought that generation may not be as wealthy as their parents and that they're living at home for a longer period of time for financial reasons.
Yep, that's very good clarification. So when we talk about these significant major donors that are coming up in the Gen X and millennial generations, we're talking about those that have the capacity for major giving, for big giving. And it's really part of a larger economic trend that, of course, most people are aware of, and it's certainly affecting, you know, wherever in the broader society, and it certainly is found in the philanthropic sector, maybe even more dramatically, this idea that, you know, resources are becoming more and more concentrated in fewer and fewer individuals and families. In the nonprofit sector and in the philanthropic sector, it means that those people who have the ability to make significant gifts, those that are the beneficiaries of this wealth concentration, and then, as I said, wealth transfer that's going on, where, you know, baby boomers and the greatest generation are now passing wealth on in their families to the next generation. Those are the ones that we're talking about as having a real impact on the field for you know, in 2018 and for decades to come.
And just out of curiosity, where are you getting this projection from? What are you basing this on?
This was based on several years of research that we've been doing among these rising major donors. So it's a project that the Johnson Center for Philanthropy at Grand Valley has done in my program here on Focus on Family Philanthropy. We've done in collaboration with an organization in New York called 2164. And we've done 75 in-depth interviews and a survey with 300 of these folks who are in this small group of very influential major donors and major donors to be. But the point about the importance of this group is not something that just we're saying. This is something that the field broadly recognizes, and certainly nonprofits and fundraisers, if you talk to them, they are very aware of how important the next generation of these major donors. They know how important they're going to be, and they're trying to figure out, okay, how can we engage them in a way that supports our organization?
You're listening to WMUK's West Southwest. I'm interviewing Michael Moody, a researcher at the Johnson Center for Philanthropy at Grand Valley State University, about its new report about 11 trends in philanthropy for 2018. One of the trends is more global giving.
Yeah, so I think, you know, this is, again, one of those things that people have an inkling of. If you, you know, watch the news, you know that there are billionaires being created in China. More, you know, there are more billionaires in China now than in the U.S., and they're being created at a faster pace. And that's true in many other places. And we see, you know, the giving pledge that was started by Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett to try and encourage billionaires to commit half of their fortunes to charity. That's now going global, and they've very explicitly wanted to go global with that to try to encourage giving. There's a lot of sort of there's longstanding traditions of giving, of course, in every culture around the globe. There's, you know, charitable giving of some sort exists in all societies, but what's changing now is the sort of the globalization of the philanthropic activities and institutions and norms, really. So that you know, the way that we're familiar with philanthropy through, you know, foundations and major donors making, you know, long-term commitments and those kind of things, and being very public about their giving in certain ways, you know, those are some of the things that we're beginning to see spread across the globe in the same way that many things are sort of spreading globally, where cultural norms are becoming, you know, more broadly practiced in different places rather than just in the West. And that has positive and negative outcomes, of course. You know, it's great that these newly wealthy, significant donors, who, you know, would be the philanthropists automatically in some ways if they were in the United States, in places like China, are turning their attention to what can I do to really, you know, lead change and create impact in my community. That's fantastic. It does also mean that we face the challenge of, you know, is it going to be that what academics would call cultural hegemony? You know, that the Western way approaches to doing things may not always fit in other places around the globe, and we need to be careful to not just assume that our way of doing things is going to be the best for Brazil or for, you know, Australia or Western Europe.
And another trend is collaborative giving and giving circles. I think you kind of referenced a little bit of that earlier. I think you said some of the younger givers like to do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and this is one, by the way, that's interesting to the broader set of younger donors rather than just those who are at the top end. The idea of crowdfunding. When you have a cause that you want to get behind, or there's a disaster, or somebody has a personal challenge, there's, you know, the idea of using these crowdfunding platforms, using social networks and other ways to build support among a broad base of of smaller donors and people helping out in certain ways, but turning to those collaborative vehicles to do that, to do that funding, I think is certainly something that is going to be even more significant in 2018. What they get from that collaborative is two things. They get leverage, that is, you know, they pool their money with other donors in a way that they can make an even more significant impact on what they're focused on, whether that's poverty or women and girls, the environment, climate change, whatever. They get leverage, but they also get learning. They, by giving with other people and learning together about problems, they're able to improve their own giving, be more strategic in their own giving by learning from peers that they engage with in these institutions. And so the model of the giving circle and the model of the collaborative giving approach is very powerful and one that I think is going to continue to go. We certainly know from our research it's going to continue to grow.
And then there are some trends that appear to be driven by the changing demographics in America, essentially the browning of America. Could you talk about some of those trends in philanthropy? One, I know, dealing with equity and inclusion.
Yeah, well, this is one that I think you see certainly with major institutions in the field, very well-known institutions, you know, including some of those here in Michigan, you know, most notably the W.K. Kellogg Foundation in Battle Creek. But really, it's true about the Ford Foundation, which is taking a very direct focus now on Detroit and other giving back in Michigan. You know, both of those institutions have dedicated, clear institutional commitments to funding in ways that advance race equity and that address racial inequality. And that is an emphasis, a point of emphasis across the grant making in both of those institutions that, you know, has really come to the fore in the last few years and is infusing their work, will certainly infuse all of their work in Michigan as well as elsewhere in 2018. But they're not the only ones. There's a significant, you know, it's not as though race is a new issue for philanthropy or certainly for the nonprofit sector and those people working for change in communities. But I think it's becoming even more clear as a priority, and we're recognizing the complexity of addressing race and bring concerns of equity into our giving and into our the ways in which we act in communities together to create change. People are trying to be much more careful and sophisticated about how they talk about race equity, how they engage with communities, full range of diversity within their own communities. If we're talking about place-based giving and place-based activity, it's, you know, it's no longer just say, you know, we have an organizational value that commits us to diversity inclusion. It's, what does that look like on the ground? What does that look like when we go out and try to address a concern about, you know, schools in our community? Well, if we want to do that in a way that's inclusive and committed deeply to equity, that's going to mean certain kinds of practices of engaging with the community. That's going to mean certain ways of using information and gathering information in inclusive ways that help us to really address that problem. So I think it's not that race, you know, the concerns about race equity and the concerns about inclusivity and diversity are new to 2018. It's that we're beginning to understand the deeply complex and pervasive ways in which we need to engage with those issues and have them inform our work across all aspects of the work. I think that's what's really new.
One of the trends also is place-based philanthropy, more focus on organizations and goals that are specific to a geographic area. You kind of referenced it in your response just a few seconds ago.
People are both paying more attention and recognizing how things are moving on a global scale. We certainly have more information about global problems. We're much more globally aware. And so globalization is clearly happening and certainly affecting the nonprofit sector and philanthropy. But that doesn't mean that local attention and focus on place-based giving and being more hyper-local many people being more hyper-local in their own personal attention to what they want to give to and be focused on. And I think it's good news for local communities, of course. And I think there's innovation that's happening at the local level as well. So it's not just that we're saying the trend is that people are continuing to pay attention to their local communities. It's that they're turning their sort of entrepreneurial, innovative, and evidence-based, really data-focused approach to giving and to solving problems to the local level as well. So there's new ways in which people are using data. There's new ways in which people are trying to experiment with new ideas in local areas. And so there's, it's in some ways, the giving in local areas to communities around this country is becoming in some ways a sort of a hotbed of innovation and experimentation to try to then see what works. And if it works in one community like Kalamazoo, maybe it's going to work in, you know, Reno, or it could work in Phoenix or somewhere.
Another trend is partnership between government and the philanthropic community.
The innovation and creativity, if you will, within that those partnerships is at a level that it's never been before. Because our problems are acute and because we want to be smart about addressing them, trying new ways of partnering government and philanthropy in the nonprofit sector, trying those partnerships is going to continue in places like Kalamazoo and Flint and Detroit and Grand Rapids and elsewhere. But we're going to be careful about assessing, okay, what's working, what's not working with these. And by the end of 2018, hopefully we have some better understanding of, well, this is how to do this in other communities that are facing similar challenges.
Michael Moody is a researcher at the Johnson Center for Philanthropy at Grand Valley State University. To hear a longer interview and for a link to the center's full report, visit our webpage at WMUK.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. When former Michigan Governor John Engler was named interim president of Michigan State University, the vote of the Board of Trustees was unanimous, but the reaction was sharply divided. Supporters called him a strong leader who will make immediate changes. Critics have questioned appointing someone from the world of politics rather than academia. A story in Bridge raises questions about how Engler handled allegations of sexual assault in Michigan prisons while he was governor. Ted Roloffs has written about Engler's appointment, the reaction, and the former governor's handling of sexual assault in state prisons for Bridge. Ted, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, glad to be with you.
Give us an idea of what these allegations were, the scope of the allegations of sexual abuse in Michigan prisons that were going on while John Engler was governor.
Yeah, these surfaced in the early 90s. There were a variety of reports about abuse, sexual abuse, and other forms of abuse of female prisoners in state prisons in Michigan. And this was parallel to findings in a lot of other states that this was going on. There was a report by Human Rights Watch in 1996. They looked at Michigan as well as other prisons, California, Georgia, Illinois, New York, as well as Michigan. In Michigan, it found, I'm quoting here, a serious problem of sexual misconduct in Michigan women's prisons, including rape, sexual assault and abuse, criminal sexual contact, inappropriate visual surveillance, and verbal degradation. So that was 1996. And around that same time, the Federal Department of Justice was also investigating complaints of abuse in Michigan prisons, and it filed a lawsuit in 1997 on this issue. So that's sort of the predicate for what Bridge reported regarding then-Governor Engler in 1998, when the United Nations, following on the heels of this other reporting that I just cited, sought permission to enter Michigan prisons to investigate this issue. And at that time, I think it was June of 1998, Governor Engler wrote a letter to the United Nations High Commissioner denying permission to enter Michigan prisons to look at the issue of abuse of female prisoners. And he referred to the DOJ lawsuit in this letter, calling it baseless and without merit. And I'm going to quote here another portion of this. "I view the United Nations as an unwitting tool in the Justice Department's agenda to discredit the state of Michigan in spite of the objective evidence the state of Michigan has not violated the civil and constitutional rights of women inmates." And then when you pair that with a parallel lawsuit that was filed in 1996 on behalf of female prisoners, that lawsuit ultimately was settled well after Governor Engler was out of office in 2009, but it's on these precise issues, and that lawsuit was settled for $100 million, which is the largest settlement of its kind in the state.
So it does appear that there was credibility to these claims despite then-Governor Engler's objection to the Justice Department and the United Nations looking into it.
I wouldn't say appears would be the right word. I don't think the state would settle for $100 million were there not credible evidence. I think that's beyond question, that this abuse was going on in prisons. And it took 13 years of litigation on this lawsuit for the state finally caved in and said, you win $100 million. I think that speaks for itself.
And the attorney who was helping try this case on behalf of the women in prison questions at this point why Michigan State is turning to former Governor John Engler to come in and become interim president at a time when the university is dealing with a massive sexual abuse scandal.
Yeah, her name is Deborah LaBelle, and she was involved in that suit, as I mentioned, going all the way back to 1996. So I think she has more than just a litigation and stake in this. I think for her it becomes rather personal. And the quote I got from her was, really, guys, this is who you bring in? No, and I spoke to a spokesman for Governor Engler, John Truscott, who was his spokesman throughout his term as governor. He didn't feel that this portrayed of the governor's take on what was going on in Michigan prisons with regard to female prisoners was fair. He said that the governor had little to do with how the Department of Corrections was handling that lawsuit. It wasn't something that he was closely involved in. And he also noted that as governor, ultimately, I think it was late, maybe in 1999 or 2000, that state prisons put only female guards with contact with female prisoners, took the male prisoners out of those prisons. That move by the Department of Corrections was ultimately fought in court. There was a lawsuit by the prison guards alleging this was discriminatory, but ultimately a federal court upheld that, so that stood.
But while he was still governor, John Engler and the legislature also pushed through an amendment to the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, which kept prison inmates from seeking state civil rights protections. So there's a little more to the story than just this one letter to the UN.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's really, had this amendment to the Civil Rights Act stood, it would have ultimately curtailed the very rights that brought the female prisoners this $100 million settlement. And so, again, I guess it might lead you to question where the governor stands on whether a person is a prisoner or not a prisoner on the issue of sexual abuse and what sort of protection should people have for that. That amendment was ultimately struck down in federal court, so it did not stand.
You also did reach out to Michigan State's Board of Trustees, and you did have the opportunity to talk with one of them, Diane Byram. What did she say?
Well, she said that, and I don't believe that she was aware of the narrow issue that Bridge had broken on this story, which was that letter that Governor Engler had written in 1998 to the United Nations. I do not believe she had seen that document. It had not been published before. She said that she disagreed with what she called decisions he made in the 1990s. She said, referring to the way the state of Michigan was handling complaints of female prisoners and lawsuits regarding that, she said she disagreed with that. However, she added that she still believes that she thought that John Engler is the right person at this time to lead Michigan State University forward on this issue, and also said that she would be very vocal in disagreeing with the former governor if she didn't believe that he was following through on his vow to change the culture and create greater transparency on this issue. And I think what's gone on said throughout this interview, the relevant context for this, of course, is the massive abuse scandal related to sports doctor Larry Nassar. And that's why this this issue, I think, has such relevance that it's certainly a pertinent thing to look at when you have a former governor with a track record on this issue. People can draw their own conclusions as to whether or not his actions and statements in regard to this are indicative of an attitude that some people might not find responsive. I guess that's up to people looking at the record as to what kind of conclusion they would draw.
And Diane Byrum, as you note in your story, actually came into the legislature the same year that John Engler became governor. She's a Democrat and was on the opposite side of John Engler on many issues. And as you know, chronicled in your story, disagrees with him or says that she has disagreed with him on the prison sexual abuse matter, and also voted against that change to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. So I suppose after reading that, you kind of wonder where she squares the circle and comes back to, but I think John Engler is the right person going forward to lead Michigan State at a time when it is dealing with a horrible sexual abuse scandal of its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the hard place that the board can get into on this is the desire not to come apart at this time, that they've made their choice, they've made their pick. It's John Engler, and to backtrack on this now, I think there'd be a lot of fear that it would create even more chaos. It's worth noting, as we're talking about this, there was a town hall meeting, I think it was last Thursday, at Michigan State University for students and faculty. I think there were several hundred people there, and MSU board member Brian Musalem was at that meeting, and he actually said that he wasn't in favor of the hiring of Governor Engler, but he did it for the sake of unity. And someone at the meeting was reported to have shouted out, "You're a coward." And someone else addressed him specifically on this issue of how he handled the sexual abuse case regarding female prisoners and felt that disqualified him as someone who should have been hired for the role of interim president. So this clearly... nerves are raw at MSU, understandably, among students and others, and obviously this issue is not going to go away.
And as I hear you talk about Brian Musalem there and holding this town hall meeting where he's being shouted at, I would think most university trustees are not used to that. And the way you start your story on Diane Byrum is, on a normal day, Michigan State University trustee Diane Byrum said she might get an email or two on her MSU email account. These days, it's more like 100. And I guess that leads me to wonder if these trustees at Michigan State are getting more scrutiny now and more attention than they might be used to.
Oh, I think this is by, almost literally 100-fold the kind of attention they're used to. And I think it just stems from the abhorrence that people have for what happened, the fact that a sports doctor from MSU over a period of decades could violate more than 200 young women with various reports of complaints against Dr. Nasser, and yet somehow he remained in practice for two decades doing this. And people look, they want answers, they want accountability, and they want somebody, to take responsibility for this. And I guess it's logical they would look at the board and say, "You let us down." Again, we don't know how much the board could have or should have known about this, and whether this is an indictment of the way they've overseen this university, and whether or not even the former president, Luana Simon, could be ultimately held accountable for this, which she was, and that's why she left her job. But I think that pressure on the board is just a logical result of how strongly people feel about this at MSU, that this is wrong, and we need to do things differently in the future.
Ted, thank you very much for your time.
Glad to do it.
Ted Roloff's stories for Bridge on how John Engler handled allegations of sexual abuse in Michigan prisons and the reaction to his appointment as interim president at Michigan State University can be found at bridgemi.com and also through a link at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.